Joyner Report. I would love for anyone listening to go to UFOParanormalRadioNetwork.com and join us in the virtual auditorium or chat room through PalTalk and submit your comments or questions there. Before we begin, there are a few people that I would like to thank right now for helping me get the show started. First, UPRN's Joe Montaldo for giving me this opportunity. David and Dee Andrew, who both guided me and helped sway me in this direction. My friend Sherry Boardman, who is sitting at my side now and who supports me continuously. Also, Grant Cameron, a respected researcher in the field, who encouraged the show and has become a great friend who has tirelessly worked to educate me in this field. I'd also like to thank Paul Robinson, my webmaster, who does excellent work for AngelaJoyner.com. For those of you who are not familiar with who I am, here's a little background. I am the reporter that broke the Stephenville Light story in Texas that made international news in January of last year. You can see my work at www.AngelaJoyner.com, and I encourage you to visit the site. Lots of great pictures and stories there. So that was my 15 minutes of fame, and it's led me on a path that I knew nothing about. UFOs were not really of interest to me until I got that fateful phone call from Steve Allen that set me up on a new course. Now I'm very interested in the subject, and being a former public school teacher, I consider myself a lifelong learner, and I have a natural curiosity about a lot of subjects. Only being in the field for slightly more than a year now, I still have a lot to learn. That is the perspective that I'm doing this show from, because I feel there are others out there like me that are new to the subject, especially after the increase in the number of sightings and mainstream media coverage last year. Okay, so that's enough about me. Let me introduce my first guest tonight, Miles O'Brien, a multi-award-winning journalist, formerly CNN's chief technology and environment correspondent. For 10 of his almost 17 years at CNN, O'Brien covered the space program. In February 2003, he led the network's coverage of the loss of the space shuttle Columbia. Welcome, Miles. I have the utmost respect for your work, and I'm thrilled you agreed to be on the show tonight.
So it's a great pleasure, Angela. I guess I'm kind of like Billy Crystal to you, right? Because that wasn't Billy Crystal, the first guest on Jay Leno. So
yeah, right.
You're Billy Crystal. Think of it that way. I don't think I'll be quite as funny, but it's a pleasure to be here with you, and it's nice to be part of the inaugural broadcast, beaming out to the entire cosmos right here tonight. This is history being made.
This is history. I'm very excited about it. Okay, Miles, when you departed from CNN shortly after doing your week-long UFO series in November, I started getting a lot of phone calls and emails and such, and there was a cry of foul that went up from your fans and particularly from the UFO community. That's how I first got in contact with you. And let's just get that out of the way. Let's talk about how you feel. Did your departure have anything to do with your coverage of the UFO topic?
Well, you know, we have an expression in the newsroom, Angela. There are some stories that are too good to check out, and this, unfortunately, is one of those. A lot of people think, wow, he did a UFO series, and that's why they spiked him. Well, it's not quite that way. I will tell you this, though. The UFO series was not was a controversial series inside CNN, and there were some people who didn't want me to do it, some people in management. And so to that extent, it certainly probably didn't help me to do it because some senior managers thought it wasn't such a good idea. The person who was in charge of the morning program was the person who came to me and asked me to do it, and I've always been interested in the subject, and it's not the kind of thing that CNN historically has allowed to extend beyond Larry King's hour. And so I thought it'd be well worthwhile doing a series on it and exploring the boundaries of this story, defining the boundaries at the very least. And so I found the project, I was enthusiastic about the project. I had done a documentary a few years prior on the whole push for more research in astrobiology, and it was more life in extremes and everything up to the sightings of UFOs. So it didn't quite get into that subject matter. So this is kind of where I left off on that documentary, and so I did it. But my departure and the departure of the entire science and technology unit is part of a much bigger story, which has to do with network priorities, where mainstream media is on coverage of science and technology, and frankly, the budgetary realities of television right now, and the fact that I was getting paid a fair amount of money for as a reporter because I used to be an anchor, and all that kind of stacked up against me. And I, you know, it's a business that when you go into it, you know there's going to be a day where they're going to say goodbye to you for no good reason, and that day came after 17 years. I had a great run, and I was kind of liberated to be out of there. Was the UFO the series what caused me to be fired? No. Was it part of the whole picture of things that may have stacked up against me? Maybe.
Okay, well, that's fair, and that sounds honest. Was it a sweet week when you did that series?
You know, I don't know if it was. In cable, you don't have tweets like you do in local news. We don't have the so-called ratings books. It's different. It's in local markets they do that kind of stuff in November and May. And so in our part of the world in cable, it's just every day is another ratings day, and every week is the same as any other.
Okay, and then. You want to explain to our listeners about the John Podesta piece that was in your series, and people sort of became alarmed when CNN did not put that section on the website update. You want to explain how that happened?
Yeah, it's that's one of those things that people draw some conclusions. And I can see why they would. Basically, what happens, when you do a story like that, you come on and you have a little live segment with the anchors, and you have a tape piece, which you which we call a donut, and you're the outer ring of the donut, right? Whatever. And so the donut was the tape piece, and usually what happens is that the donut is the portion that gets put on the web. The live portion, the interchange between the anchors and the correspondents, typically do not. I don't know why it's done that way. I don't think it's a good idea, except that I think it's easier from a workflow perspective because they don't have to go and grab the actual recording of the show. You know, the donut, so to speak, is already in the system. It's already digitized, and it's easy for them to put it on the web. So there's a logistical reason they do it that way.
Okay.
In this case, it would have been smarter to include the live portion of this thing because, in particular, the way we structured that story is we made the Podesta portion of it, the discussion about him and the soundbite from him, part of the live tag. So we did the donut, and we had a little interchange at the anchor, and I answered her, and we included the Podesta material in that. And because that was part of the live content and not the tape version, it did not, as a matter of course, get on the web. So it's just one of those inside baseball, how they make sausage kind of answers. But that's exactly what happened.
All right. For those of you listening who may not be familiar with Podesta, he is the former White House chief of staff, and he was leading the Obama transition team. A few years back, he had called for a release of U.S. Files and documents on the UFO phenomena, not only because, as he said, and I'm paraphrasing, it was the right thing to do, but it was the law. He also said the American people could handle the truth. UFO enthusiasts were really encouraged when that happened, and as he led the transition team for President Obama, some began to think that he might be able to influence the president to actually let go of some of those files and documents and make them public. Miles, do you think Podesta has that kind of influence, and did you try to get an interview with him?
We did try to reach out to him, and he was not available. He was in the middle of the, they were still in the middle of the transition. And so, unfortunately, we couldn't get him. I don't put anything, stock in that, into that being anything nefarious necessarily, except that he was just busy, and I think they had their focus in a very specific area. But I do think he's a very powerful member of this administration. He was also a pretty powerful member of the Clinton regime. But I think that. Maybe the time is finally right. I mean, I not long before I did this piece, Great Britain released its files, and it didn't cause panic in the streets. It's kind of a quaint notion to think that people would be, beside themselves if there was some disclosure, and that in 1948 or whatever it was in Roswell, something odd happened, and we can't explain it, or here's the evidence. All these things, I think, frankly, probably the reality is less than the tales that have been spun ever since, because people assume there's more to it. I think that frankly, what's going on in the world right now is there are a lot of big fish to fry, and this issue, probably in the grand scheme of things in the Obama administration, doesn't have a top priority, frankly. But that good chance that'll change. And I'm a reporter. I will always be on the side of releasing information whenever it's bottled up. And the fact that there are still files that haven't been released is pretty amazing to me. And it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't. Of course, it's crazy that it is. Why not open the files at this point, especially for stuff that's 50 years old and so forth, and let people make their own judgments. And frankly, sitting on this kind of stuff only it ultimately makes matters worse. I think my sense of it is that it's almost like secrets like this tend to get develop a life of their own. It becomes so big and kind of embedded and almost they become ingrained in the bureaucracy that you get to the point where no single individual has the authority, the wherewithal, the situational awareness, whatever you want to call it, to spill the beans. And so as a result, it becomes kind of a stalemate. From what I gather is that the presidents of the United States are really not clued into the big picture. So ultimately, I guess, if a president really made this a priority, that could change. But, I think Barack Obama right now has other things on his mind, frankly.
Why do you feel that presidents of the United States may not be clued into the big picture?
Oh, I don't know. I think, secrets develop a life of their own, and it becomes, is there any reason he needs to be briefed on it? Is kind of, I suppose, the question that is said internally. I don't know that for a fact. I don't know enough about who knows what. And maybe at this point, most of the institutional knowledge, the human knowledge about this is maybe long gone and out of the government. And maybe there's stuff in files that nobody knows about. It could be a lot of it. It's kind of, imagine the warehouse in Indiana Jones, and some crate there with a bunch of documents that no one knows what's in them at all. And it's just a matter. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I think I put this more in the realm of bureaucratic inertia and ineptitude than something that is sinister. That's just my general take on it. I think. I'm a skeptic. I'm a reporter by nature as a skeptic, but I do think that secrets like this are pretty hard to keep, unless it's just through utter incompetence. It's probably more, and all things being equal, I'd be willing to believe our government first and foremost is incompetent, because they've shown that time and again to us publicly. and to assume that the same government that blundered us into the Iraq War or gave us the response to Hurricane Katrina and all the ineptitude that we see on every level, to assume that that same government is so sharp that it, you know, that it has these secrets and spaceships and all these things hidden and efficiently taken care of and nobody's talking, there's a disconnect there to me. So I think it's more a case of just, you know, kind of incompetence, which runs amok in government.
I would have to agree. I think Clinton did have a genuine interest in the subject, and he really did try to find out what was going on, but I'm not sure, you know, he was able to do that either.
Yeah, it's well, I we know where Podesta is. I don't think I haven't seen anything. Maybe your listeners have some insight on this, on what Obama thinks about this. But like I say, it's just there's so much else going on in the world right now. I mean, I think we just today realized we finally have a NASA administrator. That shows you how the priorities are right now. It's just it's a difficult time in this country, obviously, and so we might have to be a little more patient. But you know, truthfully, why not let it out? Let it out, and let's let the world look at it, and we can determine on our own exactly what's in there, what's not. And you know, I thought it was fascinating that those British files. I read quite a few of them, and that got me to down to Florida to meet Milton Torres, the F-86 fighter pilot who had that very unusual intercept of some blip on our radar screen. And, you know, Milton is a PhD engineer. He is a, he is a stand-up quality, bright, sane American. And get him down, and he has no, he's an engineer. He has no earthly explanation for what he saw. And, he's not come out of left field. He's the real deal. So, that I thought that was one little interesting piece of that disclosure. And I think that, like I say, I didn't see any panic in the streets of Great Britain. Did you? I think people can take it. And I don't understand at this point, with the Cold War over and people sophisticated enough to understand all this, I don't understand why anybody would hold on to this stuff, except going back to my previous answer, which is, just sheer incompetence.
Yes, and I admire somebody like Torres that, feels that, he can now speak out since those files were released. And he's a regular guy. He's, so many people do the tongue-in-cheek, the UFO whole thing. They're a bunch of kooks, and that's not really the case. I've met some of the most intelligent people I've ever met in my life in the last year. They're very smart, very educated. They've done their research, and it does seem like there is more to this than we really know.
There's definitely more to it. There's definitely more to it because there are files that haven't been released, but. In the final analysis, is there a smoking gun in those stacks of documents? That's the question we don't know the answer to. It would be nice to be able to evaluate that on our own, but there's definitely more information. We know that for a fact. There's more information inside these files that hasn't been shared, and why not let it out? Let the sun shine upon it.
You had a sighting about 20 years ago with your wife. Is that correct?
I did, and it really was an amazing experience for both of us. We were in near Augusta, Maine, at a cottage that my father-in-law rented in the summertime, and it was one of those, kind of between 8 and 9 p.m. kind of dusk periods in the summer, and we were looking to the pretty much, I guess it was the southwestern sky, and we saw it was very distant, and it was a bright light associated with it, and we saw it, in a hover state, and kind of caught my eye, and I'm a pilot, so I'm always looking at stuff that's flying and in the air anyway. And as we were looking at it, it did a dogleg and took off with at an impossible rate of speed. So, you know, what was that? Was I looking at a meteor from an odd perspective? Was it coming at me and then it kind of, you know, went a different direction? That seems unlikely. Was it some kind of, you know, military aircraft that was under testing? Possibly. Was it maybe a satellite that was passing overhead and the sun caught it, the gleam of the solar panels or something? Or was it something otherworldly? I don't know. I can't say. But I can tell you this. It was not anything like what I normally would see flying in the evening sky. So I don't have any way of figuring out anything more about it, frankly. I suppose I could try to remember the date and see if I could pull some radar records and so forth. And maybe that'd be kind of an interesting thing to do, but the point is, it made me think that, you talk to, for example, a lot of these astrobiologists who are involved in the kind of the hunt for life outside our planet. And when you get, they're pretty much certain, you know, when you stack up all the numbers of planets and the odds and so forth, they're pretty much certain there's life out there somewhere. And it would be actually very surprising to them if there wasn't, you know? And so, but then when you ask them, well, what about this notion of, you know, UFOs, intelligent life, visiting here one way or another? And they immediately say, oh, that's impossible. Well, I say, well, you know, to me, that's an inconsistent argument. You know, if you're going to say it's all but certain that there's life out there, you can't say it's impossible. You cannot say it's impossible that some sort of intelligent being has made it here. Now, what they'll say is, well, the laws of physics are the laws of physics, and the universe is too big, and the time is takes too much time to span it. But we've been studying physics for, I guess, about 500 years, and I think it's probably a little bit presumptuous for us to assume we know everything about it. So I think that, you know, you can't summarily dismiss all this stuff. Have I seen proof that it exists? I haven't seen it yet, but I've seen some things that are very, you know, unexplainable, and it makes me want to know more. So that's where I sit.
That's how I am. It makes me want to know more. And since you brought up the fact that you are a pilot, mm-hmm. Nick Pope is a researcher in the UK. And he feels that UFOs should be investigated by government officials, if for no other reason than the fact that they are an air traffic safety hazard. Do you agree with that?
Well, you know, I mean, that's as good a reason as any. Why not? You know, I mean, yeah. I mean, I haven't heard of an airplane clonking into a flying saucer, but I suppose it could happen. I mean, we've certainly seen the Stephenville case is a classic example of the fact that you know, something's being painted on a radar, and if there's something being painted on a radar, it's possible that my little plane could conk into it. So, I think that, you know, that's as good an explanation as or reason, I should say, to look into.
Well, there have been numerous pilots that have come forward, and you know, they've noticed something in the sky near them. You know, they didn't know what it was. You know, at times, it would seem that would be air traffic safety hazard. So I thought that was an interesting aspect.
Yeah, no. I suppose, in theory, it could be. And listen, if the goal was to get these records released, you got to use every lever you can. And why not throw this one in the mix as well? But, I mean, the fact is, over the years, pilots are, I would say, as a group, probably, pilots are probably the most frequent reporters of UFOs, I think probably obvious reasons, because of the vantage point they routinely have above our planet. And but I don't know of any collisions that have occurred, so,
Right.
Anyway, so I think that, like I say, I, you know, it, it's not going to hurt to, in my opinion, it's not going to hurt to let these records out. I can't imagine what would be in there that would, put people in a complete tizzy at this point. Not 1953 anymore.
Right. You've done extensive work on shuttle launches, NASA leadership, just the general NASA environment, and I was just wondering if what you thought about Obama not filling that leadership role at NASA as of yet.
Well, of course, today the news is all but confirmed that Charlie Bolden is going to get that job, and I think anybody who cares about our space program should applaud that choice. He's fantastic. Really a big fan of Charlie's. He's got a great Horatio Alger story, growing up in, African American in the poor, segregated South, rising to go to the Naval Academy, going to the Marines, flying fighters, being a test pilot, flying space shuttles, becoming a general. I mean, he is just, this is an all-American success story, and he's got the right stuff, and he also knows his stuff when it comes to the space program. And I think they finally, the administration has finally realized that this is the right choice. There was some hesitation because it's difficult, especially in the space business. It's a very small business, as you can imagine. It's kind of a niche. And the Obama administration, particularly after the whole Daschle affair, was reluctant to have anybody take these jobs who had any experience lobbying in the industry prior to their appointment. Well, it's pretty hard to find anybody in the space business who hasn't one way or another been associated with these companies. And Charlie Bolden did some work for ATK and was involved, ATK being a solid rocket motor maker. And so I think that was where they got nervous, but I think they're over that now. There was also, frankly, there was a kind of an undercurrent of concern that having an astronaut run NASA wasn't the perfect situation because the presumption is that they would focus on the white scarf team, so to speak, to the exclusion of, the chronically underfunded robotic program, which is, after all, where the real science comes from. But Charlie is a pretty sophisticated guy, and I don't see him ignoring what's going on at the Jet Propulsion Lab just because he's a Johnson Space Center guy. So I think that's good news. Now, did it take too long? Yeah, but it's taken too long to do a lot of these appointments for the Obama administration. And frankly, NASA is... there weren't any huge decisions sitting on the desk that needed to be attended to. I mean, basically, Mike Griffin had set a course. The agency remained on that course, and now there's going to be a top-to-bottom review over this summer. Norm Ongerstein is going to lead that, and hopefully, won't lead to a significant lengthening in the gap between the shuttle and what flies after it. The agency is at a, you're right, it's a very critical crossroads right now, and I think Bolden's going to be a good guy for that.
I've sort of been wondering if we've seen the end of manned space flights, and we'll see that, replaced with robotics. You mentioned robotics a little bit ago.
Well, there's an expression in the space business, no Buck Rogers, no bucks. And, the bottom line is that NASA needs the manned program. NASA was formed, was created out of the National Aeronautics Advisory Council, formed specifically to put human beings in space in the context of the Cold War. And so that's the cornerstone of the agency. And I don't see them walking away from that. Now, how would we feel if the Chinese beat us back to the moon or the Indians were to start doing orbital missions and we were no longer in that business? I hope that at that point the American people would stand up and say this is crazy. We as a nation should not walk away from this. And it's not just for the intrinsic value of being in space, but fact that it sets the stage for our nation remaining competitive in the world and inspiring kids to study math and science and all those things. So I sure hope that that doesn't happen. But, you know, there's a lot of people worried right now because, you know, when they say it's going to be a 5-year gap between the shuttle and constellation Aries and all that, you know it's going to be a 7 or who knows how long year gap because it's 5 years is a pretty tight schedule. And that's a long period of time to not be flying. I mean, listen, if the American people would spend $3 billion extra per year, you could keep the shuttles flying the whole time. But, you know, nobody seems to want to spend that money. Given the amount of money we spent on all these bailouts, it doesn't seem like a lot to me anymore.
Me either.
Yeah, it's all
you know, I hope that that's not the case. I feel like you. I think that you've got to have men on board, men and women, to really make it personal for the people and for people to follow that. And, you know, speaking of astronauts, you've done a lot of talking with astronauts. You've had up close and personal experiences through all of the shuttle launches you've covered. Have you ever spoken with Apollo astronaut Edgar Mitchell?
I sure have. Ed Mitchell, as a matter of fact, he was part of that last series I did for CNN, and you know, I've met him over the years. I'm a big fan of Ed's. I think he's a very thoughtful and interesting guy, and I think a lot of what he has to say is very interesting. He talks about a meeting he had at the Pentagon in the context, I think it was right after his after the Apollo 12 mission, where he was, you know, basically told, he claims, by senior people there that, this, you know, this is, there are files and we're sitting on them, essentially. And, you know, when, you know, would they lie to him about that? I don't know. But, you know, I don't think Ed Mitchell and what he says should ever be dismissed. First of all, he's a national hero. Secondly, he's as bright a guy as we have in this country. And third, he's thought a lot about this in a very, very thoughtful way. I would put him in the same category as Milton Torres. He's a guy who is not shooting from the hip and is, you know, he is dealing with a full deck.
Well, you know, at the Paradigm Research Group's National Press Conference, CNN covered that this year, earlier this spring, and I feel it's probably mainly because Edgar Mitchell was speaking there, and he got a lot of press last summer, even though he had been saying the same thing for the last 10 years for some reason. It caught more attention, you know, that he believes there is an ET presence already here, that the Roswell crash, you know, was definitely an alien device or craft. And I was just wondering if you've ever heard other astronauts, you know, not to name names, or NASA officials give an opinion about Edgar Mitchell.
Yeah, you know, there's a little bit of eye rolling that goes on, you know, and, you know, I think that's unfortunate. You know, I don't think that, you know, the astronaut corps and NASA and the manned space program, it's kind of a tight clique, and it kind of forces, all the members of that group to conform to a fairly narrow bill of particulars and beliefs, if you know what I mean. And anybody who's a little bit of an outlier tends to be looked at with askance, I guess. And you know, that was, you know, for that matter, Buzz Aldrin is sometimes viewed that way by the astronaut corps. And frankly, these are many of the people that are kind of viewed that way are the brighter members of the group. You know, Buzz Aldrin invented orbital rendezvous. He was the smartest of that second round of astronauts selected by far. And you know, I think there's, you know, to the extent that he doesn't kind of conform to that stick and rudder, right stuff kind of approach to life, they kind of view him as an oddball, and I think that goes for Ed Mitchell in some quarters as well, but I think that's completely unfair to both gentlemen, frankly.
I suppose Gordon Cooper would be viewed in the same way then.
Yeah,
he would have been, yeah, for sure.
And I do consider them national heroes, you know. Some people, you know, say, well, it was something about being out in space and, you know, that some sort of occurrence happened and, you know, they're just not thinking right. But if you ever talk to Edgar Mitchell, then you know that he is right on. There is nothing that gets by that man.
No, as you've had the pleasure of meeting him as well. I mean, he's incredibly soft-spoken, and, you know, he's forgotten more about this subject than I know. So he's an amazing, amazing person. That's how the knowledge that he has is tremendous, and he's done his homework. So I don't think you can. Once again, I don't think you can dismiss it if you're really being honest and viewing it without any preconceived notions. You cannot dismiss these things out of hand, period, and thus you cannot dismiss Ed Mitchell out of hand.
Right. Miles, what UFO cases do you feel are significant and that you've had an interest in?
Well,
over the years?
As you well know, Roswell's, the granddaddy of it all, and I do enjoy that. In a sense, the Roswell story is as much about the whole culture of UFOs and our interest in it, because, you know, when you start really reading about that, and the story does have a lot of inconsistencies and multiple crash sites and conflicting testimony and so forth. But frankly, the one that gave you your 15 minutes, and by the way, I'd say you're well beyond 15 minutes now. I think you're in your bonus scene at least. I think Stephenville stands apart in my opinion, because I haven't seen. Even when you talk to Milton Torres, who I firmly believe he saw what he saw, there is no radar record. There's nothing that, you know, there's no actual evidence. But what you have in Stephenville is you had people smart enough to know what to FOIA and what to capture. And sure enough, it shows something was there. Now, that to me, as a reporter, that stands apart from, I can't think of another, and there are probably people in the audience who say, oh, no, there was some, you know, event somewhere that had similar situation, and I could stand corrected. But from my limited knowledge on this, Stephenville does stand apart because there actually is some forensic evidence, and we know now that all those fighter planes were scrambled, and we know that the military was lying about it, and all those things. Make it in my mind a significant event that can't be ignored.
I don't think there is another radar report quite like the one that Glenn Schultz and Robert Powell did, because it does in fact tie 8 of the witnesses in time and direction to an unknown, you know, on the radar. So I think it is unique in that respect.
Yeah. So I mean that's one that it's not going to go away. Let's face it, and it shouldn't just go away. It should be run to ground one way or another. And I hope that eventually the full story of that comes out. Maybe nobody.
And I haven't had a chance to tell you, but back beginning in October, all of a sudden we started having all these flares dropped. We've never seen flares here before, and this would go on 2, 3, 4 nights in a row, and it was just incredible. And it was almost like they were saying, we know something's here, so we're going to shoot these flares off so that, you know, we can say that's what it was. I mean, and I am not a conspiracy theorist, and you know, I'm not quick to jump on those bandwagons like that. But it was really strange, and it went on for a couple of months.
Especially on top of everything that had transpired there, you know, why would they do that? Why, you know, was that it? Because if they're trying to make the public ignore whatever's going on, you would think they wouldn't want to be doing the flare, deals. I mean, that's just going to stir up more interest and speculation and so forth. So you have to ask, what were they doing? I don't know.
Exactly. And when I was on Larry King Live, you know, he asked me, well, Angelo, what do you think it is? And, you know, I said, well, I don't know. But beginning, you know, in the early part of it, I thought, well, it must be something military that they're testing here. And what I told him on that second show was, well, now I just wonder if it's military, why do they keep bringing it back and, you know, where people are constantly looking up now?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the, you know, if it's meant to be a secret, the horse is a little bit out of the barn, I think, huh?
Exactly.
I don't know. I think, you know, it goes back to the whole notion of why haven't the files come out? The problem is we're trying to apply logic to something that really isn't that logical. You know, I don't think that anybody really is inside the government is thinking in a very logical way about all this. And you know, all they do is compound the speculation and make the whole thing worse, much worse than it has to be, frankly. And for no good reason, except that, you know, it's ingrained culturally in what they do, right? You know, that they keep secrets. And
they do.
That's what they do.
Before you left CNN, you had tweeted or Twittered, I'm not sure how you say that correctly, that you were making plans for an hour-long UFO special. I saw that in your Twitter. So can you tell us what would have been covered in that had you been allowed to do it?
Yeah, actually, what I was going to do, Angela, I had pitched him. I said, look, we did this great series, and, the morning show, the producer who commissioned me on it just loved it, and it got a lot of good viewer feedback. And, you know, I just thought, wow, this is, you know, little silly old me. I thought I was in good graces. And so I went to one of the bosses who actually was there the day that I was fired, and little did I know, and said, hey, listen, we've got... We already had about 3 or 4 minutes for each piece. So, you know, it was between 20 and 25 minutes of television already. I said, you know, it wouldn't take too much for me to fill this out, because by the time you put in the commercials, an hour really is an hour. And why don't we go down to Stephenville and we'll do some stuff down there, and we'll make an hour of it. And we'll Eric, because this thing aired right before the holidays, I said, we'll air at, you know, Christmas week, whatever, the slow news time, and you've got a nice program that'll get a lot of ratings. And little did I know that no wonder they wouldn't say yes to that that hour. They were busy drafting my walking papers. So that was.
Well, I didn't even know it was Stephenville you planned to fill it out with.
Yeah, that was where we were going to come down there, and that was the goal, was to come down and flesh it out that way. But it just didn't happen. As we all, the rest is history, as they say.
Well, what do you think about CNN dismantling, you know, the science and technology department? You know, just as we're getting a new president on board, you know, saying he wants to emphasize science and research.
Yeah, it's really, when I think about it, not just talking about CNN here, I'm just talking about the mainstream media in general. I think, I get a little discouraged, because obviously I wrapped up a lot of years at CNN, nearly 17, with that as my focus. And, I even though I'm a history major, I was, I love the subject. I like the educational component of what I do, what I did for a living there. And the truth is, covering politics is all well and good, but, you know, it's nice to teach people something that they don't know and open their eyes to something that they're, and tell them something beyond whether Nancy Pelosi knew about waterboarding or not, or whatever the latest story of the moment is. So I thought it was, I naively thought that the audience appreciated a little sojourn from all that, but apparently not. So, but what I've discovered since I left is that the audience is out there, and there are so many other ways to reach that audience now that, you know, I say it in a kind of flip way, but you really don't need a CNN to get the word out into whether you're blogging or streaming on Ustream or parking your stories on YouTube or tweeting or, really in my case, combination of all those things. You can find an audience and communicate with them in a way that is much more engaging. It's a conversation. It's not broadcasting. And they are getting the information despite the fact that mainstream media has kind of walked away from the subject matter. So, you know, the beauty of it is when you do that, when you go into that realm, the business model is such that you don't need millions of sets of eyeballs to make it work. You know, in order for something like CNN to pay the rent and keep the lights on, they have to aggregate a lot of people. And so they sort of have to, you know, triangulate, do the lowest common denominator, figure out what the three or four best stories are that are going to keep people there, and that's to the exclusion of everything else. But in the world of narrowcasting, you can find your audience and cater to them in a way that is an inch wide and 100 miles deep. And it's great. I mean, the two shuttle launches that occurred after my CNN departure, I went down there and did six-hour programs at the Cape, streamed out without commercials on the web, and we got sponsors to support it. We made a fair amount of money doing it, and I had an absolute blast because I was on for 6 hours. I was able to talk with some of the best and brightest minds in the space business, and the audience, which numbered 30,000-40,000 depending on, and a global audience, I might add, not quite as big as yours, but 30,000-40,000 people at a time, was able to ask questions, weigh in, correct us when we were wrong. It was fantastic. It was just so exciting, and it made me much more optimistic about the future. I think that this is just the beginning of something that is going to be very powerful. And frankly, the folks at CNN, four doors down from where I was, had an opportunity to put about 2 minutes of the launch on the air. I was on the air for 6 hours. So, you know, the audience that wants space can get a lot of space in this world. And, you know, you go to CNN, 2 minutes of space, that's not going to satisfy a real space-savvy audience. So
right.
I think, in a sense, it's very liberating.
And for those listeners that aren't aware, you do have a Facebook account, and I would really encourage you to befriend Miles O'Brien, because as those launches were happening, Miles would tell us, you know, via Facebook, you know, who was the next astronaut, you know, about to load up, you know, what was going on with the weather. I mean, just little updates throughout the day. And it's so obvious, Miles, that you enjoy doing that, and that you even ask one time the question, you didn't have the show titled, and did anybody have any suggestions? I thought that was neat.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what's cool about it, is you really can have this dialogue. You can be much more relaxed when you're out there for 6 hours. I'm not constrained by producers yelling in my ear, rap, 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 or you can't say this, you can't do that, you know, because you have to conform to a CNN style book and all that stuff. It was so much fun for me. After years and years of being part of a big mainstream media organization, to just be out there with a couple of guys and a Mac and a DV camera and talking to an audience that really was interested in what we were talking about. It was really, I can't say enough about it. And, you know, I guess the real question is, can I make a living doing it? I think probably I can. You know, if you consider it with all the other things I got cooking, I think that it can be done. You can make a living as a freestanding, they call it a brand of one, whatever you want to call it, conversational marketing, whatever it is, it can be done. So anyway, I appreciate you, watching and encouraging people to be a part of it, because if you have interest in it, this is the way to watch it now. And, you know, what's interesting, too, Andrew, I was I was one of my concerns about all this the new media world is that the audience that you find will be a self-selecting audience. You'll be like preaching to the choir, if you will, right?
Right.
And you would lose that sense of serendipity that you get on CNN, where somebody in a casual way would turn on TV and see a science story that they never would have known about or heard of, you know, and would learn something. Well, what happens is in the world of social networking is, yeah, that choir are the first people there, but they're tweeting and Facebooking and bringing in their friends and their friends of friends, and in an exponential way, your audience gets broadened. So I'm not worried about that anymore. It's really it's such a powerful, efficient, and frankly, it's free tool, which is a great thing. It's free marketing, right?
Right. So really, I know you've been working on some PBS stuff. Can you tell us what you've got cooking?
Yeah, this, as a matter of fact, coming up May 20th, I believe that's next Wednesday, and you'll have to check your local listings, as they say, in the PBS world, but I've spent quite a bit of time. So, as a matter of fact, the PBS was among the first people to call me after I left CNN, WNET out of New York, and we did an hour on the subject of infrastructure, which is, you know, it's one of those stories that's kind of like an eat-your-beat story, you know? And it was really fascinating. I really, really learned a lot about transportation issues and highway funding and the, frankly, the unsustainability of our transportation infrastructure right now and how it needs to be changed and changed quickly and that it's not going to be cheap to do that. And so it's called Blueprint America, and it'll probably be either 8 or 9 o'clock on May 20th, wherever you are. And I would love for you guys to watch it. I had a lot of fun doing it, and it was the kind of piece that, frankly, the mainstream media should be doing and is not doing much of right now. These issues of sustainability, transportation, infrastructure, there really aren't any more important issues. And it goes right to the heart of our environment and our competitiveness and all the things that are important for us in this country. The administration gets it, but it's not getting a lot of play in the media, so it was really a privilege to be a part of a program where this was the priority, and it turned out to be, you know, it's not eat your beats. It's actually an interesting hour, I think.
Right. Well, it's sort of, you know, you said mainstream media is not really picking up on it. I sometimes just wonder, you know, how do they decide, you know, in mainstream, you know, what they're going to cover? Because sometimes, you know, it seems you know, you just can't second guess anything.
Yeah, well, a lot of it is, you know, focus groups and ratings and demographics and studies and, you know, they're looking at everything they can to cipher out that audience and try to get that 25 to 54 year old audience that they're after, that demo, and so, you know, that's part of the thinking almost all the time. And so, you know, I don't know. It's hard for me to really weigh in on it because I'm not the demo they're after, you know. And so what I like and what the audience presumably wants are two different things. And so it's difficult for me to say, you know, it makes sense because it's not, frankly, the stories I'm necessarily interested in. But that, like I say, they're not looking for me as a viewer, especially now, of course, but they never were. So it's
You know, people miss seeing you daily on television. I've heard a lot of comments about that. You know, we were really felt like you were sort of a family member in our living room.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, it is an intimate medium if you think about it, and it really, frankly. And this sounds a little schmaltzy, but I'm not kidding. It is a privilege to be allowed into people's living rooms and kitchens when they're making breakfast or whatever the case, because you are a part of their family, and it is something that I have always felt was something that should be treated with great respect, and I've always been, you know, really honored that anybody would want to tune me in. You know, it's kind of it's fun. It's fun to have people trust you that way and feel as if they're your friend. And I meet those people on the streets all the time, and they like you're their long lost buddy. I love that. I love that feeling that people connect with you that way. And so that, you know, I miss communicating with an audience in that way, but I found other ways to communicate, and you know, who knows where it's all going to lead at this point. But you know, I've been out of work for, you know, although I've been pretty busy for a guy out of work, but I know you can relate to that one. It's, you know, it's just a new phase for me, and I haven't worked as a freelancer before. I've, you know, 26 years working for one TV station or another, or CNN, and it's really interesting to be doing it and taking it kind of a project at a time. And I'm, you know, it's not for everyone, because, you know, and you know, I got two kids to put through college, so I got to be careful how long I fool around doing this. But I think there's a way to make a living doing it, and it's kind of fun. And I think as time goes on, the next couple of years, as this technology progresses a little more, I think it's going to be many more powerful tools, and it may not be the same box that you've been seeing me on, although it's all really going into one box. But basically, one way or another, I think I'll be connecting with an audience somehow.
Well, Miles, this hour has flown by. And I do appreciate you coming on the show. You know, I've enjoyed talking with you so much. And let's tell people where they can find your blog before we go.
Well, I appreciate you. I appreciate the plug, Angela. It is at www.milesobrien.com. Don't put an apostrophe in there. It's just Miles O'Brien, all one, no apostrophe, O-B-R-I-E-N, Miles, like the distance. And
okay.
Yeah, I've been keeping it up. I've been having a lot of fun with it. It's underneath the umbrella of a group called True Slant, which is a startup blog effort that has a lot of journalists who've left mainstream media publications and are now blogging there under this banner. And it's an interesting and eclectic and assortment of writers writing about a lot of things, and obviously I'm writing about stuff I care about. And just did an item today on the that horrible crash out at Buffalo, and I did a little item about Charlie Bolden getting the NASA administrator's job, and you know, there's stuff in there about Hubble and the space telescope. And it's just been, once again, it's freewheeling, and I can write whatever I want whenever I want, and I'd love for people to meet me there and continue the dialogue.
Well, we're at break time now, and, you know, I hope that you've enjoyed this, too, and I hope that you will come back on the show in the future.
I have enjoyed it immensely, and I would do it any old time. You invite me back, I'm there.
Okay. Thank you so much, Miles. And for the second half of the show, we will return with Richard Dolan and talk about his new book, soon to be released this summer, and I hope you'll join us then.
I've just closed my eyes. Climbed aboard the Dreamweaver train, trying to take away my worries of today and leave tomorrow behind. I believe we
Back to the second hour of the Joyner Report. And once again, here's your host, Angela Joyner.
Okay. I hope you stayed with us for the second hour. I'm very excited about this new show, and I'm particularly excited about my next guest, Richard Dolan. Richard is a respected researcher in the UFO field, and he has authored UFOs and the National Security State. He is about to release a sequel to that book. Welcome, Richard. I'm glad to have you here.
Hi, Angela. Hey, thank you for having me on. It's an honor to be on your first show.
For those that might be wondering, Miles O'Brien had some unforeseen circumstances and couldn't remain with us the second hour, and Richard has graciously agreed to fill in. I first met Richard last year after the Stephenville story broke. I think it was at the X conference, wasn't it, Richard?
I believe that's right, Angela, yes.
And we have communicated ever since, Karen and Richard and I. I saw him again this year at the Ozark conference in Eureka Springs, where he just did a fabulous job.
Thank you.
And he has, Richard, you've just done so much work in putting together this history of the UFO phenomenon. So why don't you tell us first about your first book and how that went, and tell us what you're doing now.
Sure. I wrote UFOs and National Security State, more years ago than I care to remember at this point, but it's a history dealing with the U.S. military and intelligence community's interest in the UFO phenomenon, put it simply, I guess. Back in those days, I just backed into the field really not knowing much of anything, and I thought, well, I wonder if there's something going on there, like you sometimes hear, you know, claims of conspiracy and cover-up and so on. And I took out what I thought would be a couple of months of my life to investigate it and look into the literature and find out how good is the argument that the believers made and so on. And I got hooked pretty early on. And then the next part of it was I wanted to find a nice, good 500-page history that laid out the story to my satisfaction. That my attitude about any topic of history is that there should be a good 500-page book about it. And I couldn't find one that I really wanted for the UFO field, and that literally was what made me decide to write it. The problem was that my history only went up to the year 1973. It started right from the early, through World War II, actually, and ended in 1973, and by then I felt like a guy who just run his first marathon and almost dropped dead at the end of it. And then, to my surprise a little bit, I had readers. People said things like, hey, good book, what about the rest of the story? And that was I realized I had to research the whole last 30 years of history, and then I sort of obligated myself to writing about it, and it's turned out to be not a two-volume, but it's a three-volume work, ultimately. So this second volume that I finished takes the UFO story up to the end of the Cold War, 1991. It's a good breaking-off point, I find. The good news about the third volume is that all of that research, or let's say 98% of that research, is already done. And so I actually will be in a position this summer of just diving in and writing that book. But as far as this second book and the first book, it's a very simple thesis in a way. I don't really try to overreach too much and describe what I think the UFO phenomenon is. I mean, I have my ideas, and you can glean that in the book. But what the book really gives is a very clear history of what happened, in the sense of what was our military doing throughout all of the Cold War, the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and up to the end of the Cold War now. For example, you were involved in investigating the Stevensville case, in which there were F-16s seen clearly, proven to be out there. In connection with this very, very bizarre UFO sighting, this incredible sighting. Well, what you find looking through the history, what I found, is that there were literally not tens or scores or dozens or even a hundred, but hundreds, several hundred encounters that we have documented of U.S. military aircraft with what can only be called UFOs, unidentified flying objects. And these were objects that, in some cases, were seen very clearly visually by military personnel, in some cases tracked by multiple radars, in some cases seen visually and tracked by radars simultaneously, and in other cases, many cases, in which jets would be sent up to intercept these things. And the amazing thing to me about this is not that it happened once or five times or ten times, but so many times. And when you read these reports, because we're lucky that the Freedom of Information Act for about a good 10-year period of time was especially useful in getting some of these older reports. It's not a complete dead-in-the-water thing today, but it's really not what it used to be, in my opinion. But we've got enough military reports. You start reading these, and you might blow off a couple thinking, well, maybe they didn't interpret this correctly, whatever. When you start getting to report number 25, report number 50, then you start have to wonder, wait a minute, what is exactly going on here? This doesn't look like it's a case of someone playing a joke on his commanding officer. It doesn't look like it's a case of misidentifying something. The tone of these memos is very grave indeed. They're taking this very seriously. So at the same time, they're telling the public, well, there's nothing to UFOs. So that's the classic sign, right, that they've got something important to hide. And so it's cases like that. Over and over again. If someone wants to be the most hardcore skeptic about that, that's fine. But the problem is, you've got these reports, and someone's got to explain them. And if you don't want to believe in aliens, well, I'm fine with that. But the fact is that there are reports that have to be explained, and they get ignored every year. Even now, I mean, this is starting to change a little bit. There are chinks in the wall, like your previous guest, Miles O'Brien, I think, is one of these journalists who has the courage to really speak out on this topic, and I think did so very, very well.
Yeah, but he's great.
Oh, he was excellent. But for the most part, what you find is on the mainstream media, this continues to get ignored. Even now, in my opinion, there's a lot going on in terms of a very major uptick in news media coverage. But really what you find is that there's a lack of continued analysis. So these stories make the news, and then they just fall. Like a
and
little...
it should be the greatest story of all time.
A friend of mine once described it as the effect of they fall away like a rose petal down the Grand Canyon, and they you just never hear from them again. And that's really what happens. So there's no ongoing analysis. Like the Stevensville case is an important case, but where do we hear about it today? It's gone from the media. And it shouldn't be gone because it's important. And this is so with all the others. Remember the O'Hare case, just not that long ago, in late 2006, in which an object was seen very clearly by many, many witnesses over O'Hare International Airport, kind of a big deal, right under cloud cover. About 10 or 15 people saw it, and it punched a hole through the clouds. It went so fast. These people were told by their employer, United Airlines, not to talk about it. One of them broke ranks and reported it to the National UFO Reporting Center, and it got out. And then we found out that United and the FAA had both been lying about it. So these stories, I mean, they're important, and they happen.
And it dropped by the wayside, too.
Absolutely. That's the thing. It got a bit of media saturation, then done.
Without an explanation.
Right. And so there's this is what's lacking in our media. There's no willingness to fill in the blanks or connect the dots.
Exactly. You know, when the Stephenville radar report was completed by Robert Powell and Glenn Schultz, you know, I was just really expecting. I sent out press packets to you know, everyone that had been here, you know, during that crazy time after the sighting. People, let's see, I sent it to Good Morning America. God, I can't even remember who now, but there was a lot of the mainstream media here. And when that report was completed and it confirmed,
right,
you know, that eight of the witnesses did see an unknown in the air in time and direction, I thought, oh my gosh, they are really going to jump
all
over
this. This will break it open, right.
And you know what happened? Nothing.
Right.
It was difficult for me to get it on Larry King Live. They were already going to do a show here. I didn't know that they were going to do a show here, but it just so happened they were planning on coming back about that same time, and I had to really talk and work.
And the fact that this object
to get them to change the show for that.
It was heading off to the Crawford Ranch, for God's sake.
Right.
I mean, that's amazing.
And, you know, I didn't get any response from anyone. You know, and the producer with Larry King Live, you know, she did finally see, you know, oh, this is important, and, you know, maybe we should do the show on this. And so, you know, we finally got that together, but that is really the only mainstream coverage that we got on this incredible report that took hundreds of hours to put together. So I was really disappointed in that.
Well, it's not forgotten. It won't be forgotten forever. What's happened is that, you know, I'm finding there's a long curve, a long trajectory for a lot of these stories. The Stephenville case is not dead. The O'Hare case is not dead. And I can assure you, when I deal with them in my third volume, they'll get ample coverage and analysis. So there. Regarding this other book that I've just finished, I thought maybe I could read the whole book on the air for you guys, but it might take a little while. Being about
I'm looking at your titles, your chapter titles. I love it.
Yeah, thanks. I had a lot of fun with some of those titles. My favorite one is Chapter 4, which I called The Empire Strikes Back. Do you remember the movie?
Yes, that one grabbed me.
What I had writing this book, it was a great education for me, just like writing the first one was. I mean, wow, it's got three major themes. Theme number one of this book, as I kind of indicated before, some of the UFO sightings. Not all just military sightings. There's a lot of that in this book, a great deal of American, Soviet, Chinese, European, British, French, Australian. It really, it's got a very international approach, even more so, I think, than my first book did. And what part of the reason is simply that in the earlier period, most of the reports and records are American, and I think what you find is through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that opened up a lot. So by the 70s and 80s, when I'm writing in this book, there's just more to report. So you got the military encounters, and you got all the other interesting UFO reports. So in other words, the first part of this book is if you wanted to look up something, say, oh, I heard about that case in 1979. Let me look that up, and let's see if Dolan's book has it. Hopefully you'll be able to find a good, concise, but complete description of that case. You'd be satisfied. So that's one part of the book. It's like an encyclopedic attempt to analyze the best UFO cases of the period. The second part of the book, though, is more of a, let's call it a geopolitical analysis of the whole phenomenon. So you got the cover-up. So that is, how did the military and intelligence communities seem to deal with this phenomenon? So I really tried to do a proper analysis of it in that regard. You know, only time will tell how accurate it is and how good it is, but I did my best. And I try to incorporate all of that as part of a narrative. And then the third part, and actually along the lines of the geopolitics, I should mention, a lot of it deals with what I consider to be the structure of UFO secrecy. Mm-hmm. In other words, how is the secret actually being kept? Can we get a sense of who's running the show? And I really tried to break new ground here as a researcher into this topic by dealing with this in a way that I just feel that hasn't been dealt with really by anyone. Maybe the only other person that I know of who's sort of loosely in this field might be Jim Mars, who tries to do a kind of analysis of the structure of power, and I think he does a very good job of it. But Jim doesn't just do UFOs. He does a lot of things. And I really, approaching this as a UFO analyst, trying to do a proper analysis of the structure of secrecy. So
try
to do that.
Well, since you brought that up, how do you think the secret is being kept?
Well, I think I heard you and Miles chatting a little bit about how much does the president know and is the president briefed, and this is an important part of it. I think that what's happened over the years is that this secret has gone international, and it's really not, strictly speaking, under the control of the U.S. president. Now, in the period that I'm covering in this volume, I think what we're seeing is it's a major transition period. So the sense that I get is that the earliest years, the 40s and 50s, this problem was more under the control of the U.S. government. It looks to me that during the 70s it started to move away. There's a couple of ways to
move away to where?
Ah. Well,
from the government to where in the 70s?
I would say, if I were to guess, I would say either a group like, say, the Bilderberger Organization or the Bilderberger Organization. In other words, an international group of the actual kingmakers of this world. One of the things that I found in the analysis of the two decades that I cover in this book is that every single U.S. president of that period, from Gerald Ford to Jimmy Carter to Ronald Reagan to George Bush, every one of these guys was put in by those groups, and essentially was put in by David Rockefeller. And you really can see that. For example, Gerald Ford. No one knows about Gerald Ford, right? He was the guy who Chevy Chase used to make fun of on Saturday Night Live. I remember that.
I do too.
Right, of course. And he was president for just 2 years, and he pardoned Nixon, and everyone got ticked off over that. But there's really not a lot known about Gerald Ford. Yeah, we know that when he was a member of Congress, he talked about UFOs. Well, that's kind of interesting. And maybe a few people know he was a member of the Warren Commission. Now, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Part of a real whitewash there. But what a lot of people don't know about Gerald Ford is that he was a five-time attendee during the 1960s of the Bilderberger meetings.
I didn't know that.
No, not a lot of people know that. Five times. Now, it's important because what you see with all of these is a pattern. Bill Clinton attended his first one in 1991, a year before he ran to the presidency and won. With Jimmy Carter was lifted into the White House by David Rockefeller almost personally. Via a group known as the Trilateral Commission, and this is all open, known history.
Mm-hmm.
Ronald Reagan had his own interesting interaction with the Rockefeller group. Well, as governor of California, he was very much a Rockefeller man. As a candidate in 1980, sounded a lot like Ron Paul did recently, in a kind of anti-government, anti-elitist track. And in fact, really called out Jimmy Carter and his opponent, George Bush, who at the time was running against him for the Republican ticket, and said, they're members of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission and all these elite groups, and if I'm elected president, George Bush will never be on my administration. Right. So what happened, though, is that, of course, when he got the, Reagan's campaign manager was Bill Casey, who was one of the top lawyers of the Rockefeller dynasty since forever. And then Reagan gets the nomination, and when he selected Bush as his running mate, a lot of his longtime supporters walked off the stage. They hated Bush. They thought Reagan had betrayed all of this libertarian rhetoric that he had campaigned on. In fact, it was true.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the real kicker with Reagan. Remember, he got shot.
Right.
Just 2 months after he got into the White House. He barely came within in half of an inch, an eighth of an inch of being dead. And in fact, I'm friends with a man who is friends with the surgeon who operated on Reagan. The surgeon who operated on Ronald Reagan was like a super surgeon, one of the best in the world. And Ronald Reagan was very, very lucky. He really, by any logic, should have died that day. Now, here's the thing that people don't know. The shooter of Reagan is John Hinckley, Jr. Everyone knows that name.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone knows that John Hinckley was supposed to be this crazy guy in love with the actress Jodie Foster, and in some deranged state of mind, wanted to prove his love to her by shooting the president, right? Everyone's
right.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. But here's the thing about Hinckley. John Hinckley wasn't just some guy off the street. John Hinckley was a member of the Hinckley family. John Hinckley's father was tight friends with Vice President George Bush.
Okay.
Which means that a very close friend of the Bush family nearly put George Bush in the White House. Isn't that odd?
Yes.
Yeah, very. So a couple of people tried to investigate this, including Alexander Haig, Secretary of State. He was stopped by none other than George Bush. One news media article picked it up, interviewed George Bush about it briefly, and he said, oh, yeah, isn't that weird? Yeah, I think I met him once or twice. And just blowing it off.
Well,
no one investigated.
Do you feel that Hinckley was set up in some way?
Well, it gets better. It gets better. Because Hinckley's father, the friend of George Bush, wasn't just an oil buddy and an old friend of George Bush, but as you know, George Bush was old with CIA, so was this Hinckley's father. Hinckley's father ran a particular kind of church known as World Vision. Now, you may know or you may not know, the CIA ran a lot of so-called churches back in those days. They probably still do, for all I know. Churches that were front organizations, obviously, for other types of activities.
Mm-hmm.
This one was very closely associated with mind control. In fact, it has been argued by the late Jim Keith, a now-dead conspiracy writer, and one of the people who was in that particular church run by Hinckley's dad was another killer named Mark David Chapman, John Lennon's murderer.
Right.
And it has been argued to be connected in some way with the Reverend Jim Jones as well, which a lot of people have argued was a CIA set-up cult-type thing. The point that I'm making is Hinckley's dad was associated with this CIA-type church. And
it had to do with mind control.
That's right. That's the argument that Jim Keith made. I thought it was a pretty good argument in one of his books. So all I'm saying is that there are very suspicious things. So why don't I bring this up regarding who's in charge of the UFO secret? The Bush people, George Bush himself, was very much a Rockefeller man. What I firmly believe at this point is that Reagan got in, but wasn't really quite the choice of the ultra elites. They wanted Bush. So they were going to kill Reagan, get Bush in there, and have everything. Well, Reagan lived. He kind of messed up the plans, but in a way, Ronald Reagan's survival actually was a great blessing for these people, because Ronald Reagan was the world's greatest pitch man, the world's greatest front man for all of this, in a way that George Bush never could have been. I mean, Ronald Reagan was a trained actor who knew how to talk to people. People liked him. They didn't like George Bush. Yeah. And so so he was actually pretty plus. He didn't really do anything as president. His whole presidency was run by George Bush and Bill Casey. I mean, everything. Ronald Reagan literally took a nap almost every single day, and he read cue cards. And he was really, he was past his prime when he got in there. He was in his 70s. He was the oldest man ever elected president. And he was really not up to the job of dealing with these people. They dealt with him instead.
Yes, and you know, it sort of became public towards the end of his presidency that he had some problems there.
Well, sad, you know, and this was a guy who, when he was in his prime, was a very, I think, a very intelligent and a capable person for doing the things that he did. But by the time he got in there, he was totally checkmated. So anyway, this is a long answer to your question, who's in charge? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You can ask this even today with the current presidency, in which Barack Obama sounds very much like George Bush Light as every day goes by. You know, the stimulus package to comments on Afghanistan, now to the, you know, turning about face on all the torture pictures. And so who's really in charge of these guys? Well, it turns out that Obama and Hillary both attended Bilderberger meeting last year.
Wow.
Yeah, so what's, you know...
I'm sort of speechless.
Now, I'm not saying that the Bilderbergers control the UFO topic. I don't really know who. I believe firmly that we're talking about an international group. And I say that because when you... Forget the UFO piece of it for a minute. You just look at the global geopolitical situation, what we've been seeing in the last 20 years, really, all of us, has been the death of the nation state. We just haven't really, it hasn't sunk in.
Okay, say that again. It's been the what?
Well, what we've seen in the last 20 years is the slow death of the nation state. The end of nations.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Seeing the development of international structures like, you know, back then we started with NAFTA and GATT. Strengthen the IMF and World Bank and all of these other structures that basically have taken sovereignty away from people, given it to these international unelected groups. And I think that exactly the same thing has happened with the UFO secret. The other thing that's happened with the UFO secret is that a lot of it is still operated out of the military, out of the U.S. Pentagon, but it's through what are known as the black budget programs, special access programs. And what we find with those is that they are dominated not by formal government people. They're dominated by private contractors. Again, beholden to international financial interests.
So it could be in the hands of private, businesses.
Yes, I think a lot of it is. And those aspects that are still handled by the U.S. military, because there's still, I think, a lot of that, but then we have to ask ourselves, who is that U.S. military actually working for? And so it's a long answer to the question of who's in charge. And I'll give you one other anecdote. This is something that I just learned less than a year ago from a retired high-level military officer who I was able to interview. This officer had an interview with a man who was on his deathbed only a few years ago. This man who's dying was at Roswell in 1947 and had handled alien bodies, according to...
Can we say the man's name?
No, because I don't know the man's name.
Okay.
I know the name of the man that I interviewed, and I can't give his name, unfortunately.
Okay, so it was
a highly secure environment. Right, and so this old man is on his deathbed. He lived a long life after Roswell. And this high-level officer is accompanied by security personnel, and he's able to get an audience with this dying man. And they're talking about what happened there and so on. And then this officer said, it's a shame that people such as yourself can't talk about what you know, and that you're bound by security oaths and so on. It's too bad that, you know, there's no executive order from the president that would liberate you from your oath. And to that, the man, the dying man, said, it would take a hell of a lot more than an executive order from the president to liberate me from my oath.
Oh.
Right. So then I asked this officer, well, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about international control? Are we talking about a Bilderberger type of situation? He said, yes, exactly. That's exactly what we're talking about. So that's his testimony.
Well, that's amazing.
Right. Well, what it indicates is that this secret and the control over it has gradually moved away specifically from the president. It doesn't mean that the president is irrelevant. I don't think that the president is irrelevant. I think the president still matters. But he's not the only game in town.
Right.
And, you know, every U.S. president gets his walking orders from someone. I firmly believe this.
And, you know, who knows if the presidents are informed of, you know, current UFO phenomena or even past.
I think they really can't be. I mean, think of it this way. Within the Pentagon, I mentioned these special access programs. There's the classic black budget programs. There are hundreds of them. Hundreds and probably hundreds more. I mean, it's literally impossible to brief the president on every one of those. There's not enough time in the day. Okay? So, I mean, think about what Barack Obama's had to do in the last few months. He's got a great financial meltdown.
There's just too much.
You got to kiss the babies. You got to go meet with this prime minister. You got to go over to that country. You got all these things to do. Okay? I mean, what the president has to be is a pitch man. Whether his name is Barack Obama or George W. Bush or Bill Clinton, they have to sell things. Basically, the two things they got to sell is whatever new war comes down the pike, and they got to sell you that bitter pill, which no one wants, and that's called globalization. The exportation of your job to some other country. Okay, and that is literally, as I see it, their job. So they don't really have time to be briefed on all the stuff that's going on within a $500 billion military budget. That's official money. We're not talking about the unofficial stuff like, you know, the narcotics money that's being siphoned through and all of that. I'm talking about the official stuff. They can't. There's no way. So the UFO stuff. Look, I spoke with another man, very high-level CIA, very, very, very high-level. I had one opportunity to talk to this guy. I was very fortunate. And I said, I would like to ask you about the presidents. How much do they know? I mean, the question everyone wants to know. And he said, well, it's funny you ask that. Some have known more than others. He said to me, personally, he said it was his professional knowledge that Ronald Reagan did know, a fair amount. Jimmy Carter did know. George Bush Sr. did know. He said he did not believe Clinton or George W. Bush were briefed. That was his opinion. He wasn't sure about that. But here's what he said to me. He said, presidents come and go. The bureaucracy is what stays. And for these people who manage this problem for years and generations, if they have a president, and this man said this to me, who's mentally unstable, or they don't believe, or maybe a drinking man, or may not have the ability to handle this, they're not going to tell him.
Right. Well, now, this was a person, you say it was a person, a high-level CIA person that
told
you this?
Yeah, extremely high-level.
But you can't name him because he's still working?
I can't name him. I hate to do this, you know? I hate to do this. But the only reason...
I know, it's
the only
really
reason
good
I can,
stuff. We never get a name.
This is the problem. All right, we're dealing with a national security situation. And what you find, what I have learned, is that it's not a monolithic community. There's a lot of dissension in that community. A lot. There are many people who believe that the secrecy is wrong. But the problem that they have is if they talk they can talk to, and they say, please keep my name out of this, but I want you to know just for background here. Now, that puts me in a tough position because, I mean, my job as a historian or as a journalist, you got to list your sources. So the only thing that I can really say in my defense is that 99.9% of my book is all open source stuff. I don't really have to make a case to defend it. It's all there. All you have to do is look it up yourself.
I'm always leery of someone that won't let me use their name because, you know, I'm fearful that, you know, I'm being taken down the wrong road.
Well, I understand. The only thing that that keeps me going with is that the people that I've spoken to are actually famous individuals. I mean, they're either famous internationally or they're famous within their field. They're known quantities. And so, as I see it, they're taking a risk themselves by coming to me because I could out them. And I know for a fact that if I outed them, it would cause them grief. So there's a mutual thing going on there. And but I agree with you. One has to be careful. I've been told a lot of things that I've never ever used in public discourse, and I probably never will use some of these things, even though I may think that there's truth to them. But we have to be careful. But in any case,
those things you couldn't really check out, so you just avoid making it public, right?
Well, the ones that I don't check out, or the ones that don't check out, that can't be verified one way or the other, I just let them go. Ultimately, if you just look and you don't get anything, you just have to let it go. Or
right.
as Stan Friedman famously says in this field, you put it in your gray box and you think, well, I'll keep it there and I'll check in with it later. Well, that's fine. But yes, I've gotten, I think because after my first book came out, a number of people in that community said, well, I'll talk to this guy. And so it came out of the woodwork. And
well, I was about to ask you, why do you think that this CIA high-level person chose you to share this information with?
Well, because I had a go-between who was friends with that person and said, I want you to talk to Dolan.
Okay.
So I had an in due to another person that I talked to, and that's really all that it is. So, and this is what you get with every UFO researcher who's been in this field for any period of time. You start developing connections and people you talk to, and people learn to trust you. I mean, the fact is, if I started giving away names, I would get nobody to come to me.
Exactly.
And so it's a difficult position. But in any case, I offered this story to you because the individual who told it to me does have high credibility to me. So you take it for what it's worth. I realize you can't prove it. And so you should be more skeptical of it than I am. But I'm putting it out there to say, well, if you want to trust me, well, then here it is. This is the story. But what I believe is that this is a problem that has gone beyond the formal structure of the United States government. There's a third part of my book, if I just can kind of get to that, which,
okay,
in a way, because we talked about the UFO sightings, we talked about the secrecy and the geopolitics. The third part of the book, in a way, almost became, to me personally, the most interesting part. And that was the, and it was the easiest, in a way, too, it was most fun. It was the history of UFO research itself. And it turned out to be fascinating, and here's why. Because when you really think about UFO research, in a sense, it's the history of the human species' attempt to grapple intellectually and emotionally with this problem, right? I mean, it's us.
Right.
I mean, they've been, if we want to assume that there's this phenomenon and these other intelligences looking at us and studying us, okay, we've been the passive subject of that analysis. But now here, what you really get in the 70s is the birth of an active ufology, study of UFOs. There had been people involved in this, of course, in the 50s and 60s. But what you really find is in the 1970s, you start getting an attempt by a number of organizations really to try to study and figure out just what this phenomenon was. And so there was a real evolution from the early 1970s up to the end of the Cold War, where by the time you get to 1991, it's a totally different field of study. And I just found the that path from the early 70s to the early 90s a fascinating path. And I really don't believe that it's been done as a history ever. And so I think that this book really provides a first ever true history of ufology during those periods, during those years. And I was very happy.
Because you've looked at each researcher.
Well, I've been lucky in that I've had access to an enormous amount of research material. I have all of the major UFO journals, every one. I've read every page of every one. So the MUFON UFO Journal, the APRO Bulletin, the NICAP Investigator, the KUFOS International UFO Reporter, the IUR. I have Lou Farish's old newspaper clippings going back right through the whole period, and a bunch of other very lesser-known magazines and publications going back through the 1990s and 80s. And 70s.
Richard, you must never sleep. You have a day job. You must never sleep.
I don't sleep a lot, actually. No, I'll sleep on average. What's that now?
And a family.
I have two lovely children, and I have my dear wife Karen, and got a couple of dogs and a bunch of cats, and who knows what else we got here. So I'm busy, and I sleep about on average, I'd say 5 hours a night.
Well,
but I have a lot of energy. I just go. I take good care of myself, I take my vitamins, and boom, I'm out the door and I'm working. I've been focused
on
this, Angela, for a long, long time. I feel like I've been able to do a level of research for this new book that I couldn't even do for my first book. I was happy with the first book, but this is a better book. It's more detailed research, it just goes deeper, goes farther. It's a longer book, actually. It'll be about 600 pages. And
when will it come out?
Well, it's done. In fact, I have it on the screen in front of me right now. I was just looking over the final edits of Chapter 9, which is the final chapter. I finished writing the conclusion last week. It was, I may say, almost an emotional experience. I think the book will be out in July, late June, early July. I'm looking at printers right now. I'm looking at a variety of possibilities of getting this out. It'll be out. It'll be out soon. I'll have an announcement on my website. That'll be the first place you can get it, and I'll work on distribution after that.
There are a lot of people that are looking forward to that.
I wrote this book with my head, and I wrote it with my heart. And let me say this about it. If I were to just write a book that gave all the information about UFOs that someone wanted, I might put some effort into it. But if I were to write a book that young people today, when they were older, would read and would make them cry or shake their fist or get inspired to do great things, that's a book I would devote my whole life to doing. And that's the kind of book I tried to write. I wanted to write a book that captured this topic in a way that has passion as well as analysis. And I'm hoping that when readers read this book, that that's how they respond to it, because that's how I wrote it.
And your books are great for someone like me, new to the field, you know, to kind of get an overall picture of what has gone on over the years.
Thank you. And I want that to be the case. And I think that certainly is the case with this new book. I want it to be a book that's great for the newcomer, but something that's deep and meaty also for an experienced person in this field. It's hard sometimes to write something like that appeals to a broad audience. When I write anything, I keep in mind, I always have a couple of ideal readers in my mind. One has always been my dad. I've always thought, my dad's like, you know, one of the ultimate readers in my mind. My dad's a retired cop, very smart guy, kind of a tough guy, you know?
Right.
And so I always want what I write to appeal, like to make sense to my very no-nonsense dad. If it doesn't do that, then I've failed. That's how I look at it. But then there's other readers I always have to keep in mind.
Right.
Experienced researchers or a skeptic who's just going to be trying to find any little thing to go after me, or What happens?
And it's difficult to write across a broad spectrum like that.
It's very hard. But I feel that I've done the best I can do with that. To try to hit as much, to really just, because, you know why? Because I'm really old-fashioned in one way. I believe in this thing called the truth. And I believe, furthermore, that every one of us has the ability to learn truth, and we also have the ability to speak the truth. And our language is a very adequate tool to do it. And I try to have my language and my approach as clean as I can so that I can get at it. And that's something that's accessible to anybody, whether you're starting out or whether you've been in this for a million years. That's my ad. I realize truth is a little more complicated than that, but as a writer, that is how I approach this topic. And I firmly believe in being as clear as I can. I go over everything I write dozens of times. I mean,
well, you spend so much time researching it, and I know that we're all looking forward to your new book, and
very soon.
We've got about a minute left here.
Oh, gosh, how about that?
I know, we did good. And Richard, thank you for saving me.
Angela, it was my pleasure. It really,
well,
was.
I've really enjoyed it, and I think for now we'll have to say goodnight, and I appreciate you being on the show, and I appreciate all those listeners. I know there were a couple of questions in the chat room that we didn't get to, but Richard, if you'll come on again sometime with me, we'll see what we can do about these questions that people are sending in.
I would, you know, I'm looking at them now. I apologize to anyone who's sending these questions. I'm not almost able really to read the comments while I'm doing an interview.
I'm not either.
I can't do it. So I'm sorry. There's a couple of people. I'm reading them now, and I just accept my apologies, and what else can I say? Angela, I wish you many, many wonderful shows. I think you're going to be great. It's been a pleasure doing an interview with you.
Well, thank you so much. And for now, this will be the end of the first Joyner Report ever, and I've really enjoyed it, and I hope the listeners will come back every Friday night. Thanks. Good night.